first part should be known in this contract as the party of the first part.
The witness will comply under the, this I got a C rule.
Judge Hurd is stumped by this case. I've also misplaced my judge hammer.
The justice system works swiftly in the future now that they've abolished all lawyers.
My client will suggest that your client drives my client back to your client's flat, where your client will play some James Taylor.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 510. I'm Thomas. That's Andrew. How are you doing?
I am fantastic. Well, no, you know what? I think you asking me how I'm doing is a violation of my HIPAA rights, so I'm not going to answer.
It is a medical question. Marjorie Taylor Greene, and it's more sinister than that because she's dodging a vaccination question because she's obviously vaccinated and right. Expecting other people to go die in her ideological game, I guess. And so in order to avoid saying, well, yes, I'm vaccinated, but all you plebs shouldn't be because of whatever nonsense Trump crap, she's just doing this. She's saying, oh, that's a violation of my HIPAA rights for you to ask me if I'm vaccinated.
Yeah.
Hey, yeah. Listener Thomas S. asks, Andrew, is that a violation of HIPAA rights to
no,
ask?
No, of course okay. not. That's why I'm making fun of it.
I'm just making absolutely sure that everybody understands. That was a good joke. Anyway, we've got so much going on. I'm going to waive my HIPAA rights to tell you I'm feeling great about this episode. It's going to be a lot. And also, actually, I'm feeling great about this Tuesday's episode, depending on on the pedantics.
Depending on if you're Noah.
This Tuesday's episode is Critical Race Theory Part 3, but with a, I was going to say fun twist, but fun if you like Andrew having had to listen to horrible content so that we don't have to, and then like tell us what it was.
Yeah, fun if you fun hate for me as a person. Yeah.
I'm having a lot of fun.
No, look, we're gonna go through we talked about this a little bit on Law and Awful Movies, which, ooh, by the way,
yeah,
I mean, that is out now. We did the Kraken sanctions hearing. You have to be a $2 patron for that, right? So, you know, people sometimes ask, but if you've ever thought about it, now's pretty good time. We go through the 6-hour Kraken sanctions here, and it's really good, and it's also pretty funny, I think.
We've gotten rave reviews, and it's one of those ones. I said this back during the Alex Jones deposition, too, where it's like, it's just one of those Law Awful Movies is, or Law Great Sanctions is, where you just you learn a ton about the law as well at the same time, which is, I mean, that's usually true, but this one was particularly in depth. So definitely check it out. It'll really maybe restore some of your faith in the law that you've probably lost these last 4 or 5 years to see really smart, effective lawyers with, you know, a modicum of ethical values smacking down lawyers with absolutely zero ethical values of any kind. So it's a lot of fun.
Couldn't have said it better myself, so I won't. So in the beginning of that, we talk a little bit about really productive conversation that I had on Facebook. So I wanted to continue because there's a subtle, right? Like, we gave you the introduction to what critical race theory actually is. And now, you know, the Christopher Rufos of this world are not just sitting back and, you know, they still have their complete misrepresentations, but they have a strategy if you have been informed. And so they have a response to that argument. It's horrible and disingenuous and as bad as it gets, but we want you to be prepared on that. So we're going to talk about what the actual critical race theory bills that have been passed in 10 different states, what they actually do, and show you why this public relations war that they're waging is misleading and awful. And I think you'll enjoy it.
I just see a giant in all caps here. Another announcement. Stop messaging us about Telegram.
Look, this is an Andrew was wrong. I will own up to it off the cuff in talking about the potential sanctions against Lynn Wood. I mentioned that Lynn Wood and Sidney Powell used an app called Telegram, and I said, I don't know what the hell that is. That probably some like parlor kind of right wing horrible thing. And approximately all of you have written in to say, it's not an inherently right wing thing. Sorry, I shouldn't have made an off-the-cuff remark. I thought it was kind of funny. But as we know, I'm not the humor on the show. I'm the law on the show. My responsibility to have figured out what Telegram is, and it's an encrypted message app kind of thing. And you do not have to be a right-wing monster to use it. Although, I will point out, Sidney Powell does use it,
yeah,
right?
Like,
I mean,
right-wing.
If I found out Sidney Powell was using my brand of toothbrush, I would switch toothbrushes. Right? That's
one
all,
of those right-wing
that's all
toothbrushes.
I'm saying.
Yeah.
So, Telegram's a toothbrush. If you use it, you don't have to feel bad. I'm sorry if
I swear you or something in the document, in the filing, said they had followers on Telegram. And so that,
yeah,
I think that led us
that
both down to the like, oh, it's one of those right wing Twitters that people try to make all the time. I don't know how you have followers on a encrypted messaging app. Maybe you can't. Maybe it's like, who knows? Anyway, that threw me off. So sorry about that. I was thinking of a different thing. Probably Parler.
I was. That's definitely what I was thinking of. And I was wrong. So I'm happy to.
We're wrong.
Hone up to being wrong.
So send happy, us but. Only 2 to 3 more emails a piece. And then for each of you. Just so Andrew has to read them. No,
it's excellent when people go through the back files too and are like, I was just listening to episode 138.
Oh, I know, yeah.
And, you know,
yeah.
So for the rest of my life, I will get updates about Telegram. I'm sorry. It's wrong. You know, Fine. You're right and I'm wrong. Okay.
All right. Let's get to our show.
Let's do it.
Down. Down. Okay. Update on the Texas Democrats.
Oh, I love, one of the things I love about doing this show is we get emails and we get messages. So
yeah, about Telegram. We already covered that. Oh, no.
This is this first person. So I have two bits of listener feedback on the Texas walkout from people who are at ground zero, right? So this first person, and I want to anonymize, they've requested that to share the information, but for me to anonymize them. So I will not confirm or deny if this person is a member of the Texas legislature. I will say they are either a member or an employee. And so this was about the Article 10 that we kind of glossed over. And this person says, okay, couple of things to know about the Texas legislature. Number one, I said they met 5 months out of the year. They actually meet 5 months every other year.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
So I thought I had heard they were like a specifically, and I thought there was a certain amount element of like, here in conservative Texas, we don't need our government to ever do anything. I thought that I'd picked up that vibe from the whole story.
I think you were correct to pick up on that vibe. I certainly did not see the every other year. So appreciate that.
How do you get, I want to get that job. Yeah. New recording schedule, Andrew. Every other year we do.
This is the first legislative year for the current parliamentarian. So you had asked me the question about the parliamentarians. And this person says, as far as I can tell, they seem fairly independent.
Yeah, they must. Otherwise, I feel like they already would have cheated. You know, like this would be over already.
Going so far as to rule against Republican legislation and amendments when challenged on points of order during the regular session. This killed a number of objectively terrible Republican bills. Next, the Article 10 appropriations for the legislature issue is actually kind of interesting. The reason this is part of the special session agenda is that the governor line item vetoed Article 10 in response to the Democratic walkout during the regular session, right? So before fleeing to prevent a quorum in the special session, the Democrats walked out near the end in May as we were sort of hitting the deadline of introducing new terrible bills. And Governor Greg Abbott, in response, line item vetoed, right, struck out Article 10 from the budget. This cuts funding to a bunch of agencies and was done despite the legislature funding being mandated in the Texas Constitution. So in other words, it said, you're going to walk out on us? Then fine. We're going to take a number of legislative agencies, right, and we're going to defund them. Do they have anything to do with this? No, but this is our retaliation. Well,
and it sounds like it's unconstitutional, out. Right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So you're doing a thing that, like, you know, is hardball, but not unconstitutional. We're going to violate the Constitution, I guess. Right?
Correct. And that is going to come due as of September 1. But if nothing changes, the expected effect is that members of the legislature will get paid, but staffers will not. Yeah. Now, next, and again, keeping in mind this person who I will say has stayed behind in Texas, they did literally lock us in this week. Remember we asked, the provision and I said, you know, that you call for it and they lock the door. They did literally lock us in this week. I had to knock to be let out by the sergeant at arms. Members get hall passes from the speaker in order to leave the chamber. So, you know, just like being back in third grade, you have to get a special hall pass in order to leave. And then they note, fun fact, the Texas Capitol building is exempt from fire code restrictions. Right? Because, you know, yeah, you can't lock people, right? We had that happened in California with Great White. Like people were locked into the nightclub and set on fire. So, yeah. So exempt from the fire code. The sergeant, we talked about the sergeant at arms, and the question was, sergeant at arms, you know, are they going to go out and do the Tommy Lee Jones thing?
Yeah.
By the way, I think somebody interpreted what I said as saying the fugitive was based in Texas. If I did, that was an error.
I was original. Pretty sure you did say that.
Yeah.
Well, Andrew was wrong.
I'm wrong on that too. The original fugitive was set in Indiana. But Tommy Lee Jones, just, you know, Texas Marshal to me. Anyway,
yeah, true.
The sergeant at arms is a super nice guy and is universally liked. It's his first session in that position. Now, that's real tough. It's my first
day. Now we're doing rookie. Yeah, I was going to say rookie cop. And we got all these house members, you know, going to be taking advantage of the rookie cop running around, you know, making them look foolish while everybody's trying to catch them.
Next, we've spent 2 to 3 hours a day in the chamber. Members kind of mill around, occasionally having a scrum in the member lounge. I don't think that's meant in the rugby sense. Where Republicans, quote, presumably plot evil stuff, end of quote. I don't like that. Then the House stands at ease until the following day. It's expected we will be doing this tomorrow, Saturday. This was sent on a Friday. And the body cannot stand at ease for more than 48 hours, which, you know, is just the way I want to spend my weekend.
Jeez. They should start carving the big tally marks into the wall. You know?
Yeah, I agree. Yesterday, the Republicans sang the national anthem in the chamber for no discernible reason. I don't think they realized the microphones were off. I had to share that bit. I'm sorry. That was fantastic. As I'm sure you know now, Abbott has said he will arrest any of the Democrats if they set foot back in Texas. That's a good look. And then last point on this before we get to a tiny, tiny bit more on the Article 10. A dynamic that I think is worth mentioning is that House Speaker Phelan needs the Democrats in order to remain Speaker. This is his first session as Speaker. He does not have unanimous Republican support. He was the compromise choice after previous Speaker Bonin was caught in a secret recording plotting against fellow Republicans. So really interesting insider stuff.
Yeah, this is Game of Thrones over here.
Yep. And then another person in connection with the Texas state legislature. I can say that this person, because there are thousands of these, is an employee of one of the Texas legislative agencies that is currently defunded by Abbott as of September 1st due to the veto of Article 10. In retaliation for the initial walkout, quote, even though we have literally nothing to do with the process, end of quote. And then this person notes, as it stands right now with the budget vetoed and the legislature not meeting since the Dems are in D.C., funding for 2,100 legislative jobs and staff will run out on September 1st, the start of the next fiscal year. This is an emergency and was totally done to use as hostages and prevent the Democrats from walking out. This makes them leaving even more hardball, and what Abbott did even worse. That includes everyone from the individual members' staff to the people and staff that write the bills. Specific agencies include the Legislative Budget Board, the Texas Legislative Council, the Texas Sunset Commission, and the Texas State Auditor's Office, and a few more. Sorry for all the text, but I wanted to communicate the situation and how much worse it is. Yeah, so look, we are going to see the Republicans saying, oh, well, you know, if the Democrats, I don't know why I just had Bitch McConnell become the Texas legislature.
I think you said Bitch McConnell, which I love.
Yeah. think I said Mitch, but that's fine. Maybe I swallowed hard on that. Anyway, I was slipping into Mitch McConnell for evil Republican voice. But in any event, you will see stories as we get closer to September that say, you know, well, if the Democrats don't come back, then they're going to be responsible for firing all, you know, and not making sure that all these employees don't get paid. No, they aren't. And we appreciate the inside view based on that. So had to share that with the listeners. I thought all that was incredibly fascinating.
That is. I love those emails as well. It's fun when we have people on the ground floor. Sorry that that's not a lot of fun being locked in with a bunch of old gassy. I'm just adding that, but it was implied in the email.
I presume. Yeah.
Old gassy lawmakers.
Well, that was a delightful section. Thomas, are you ready to head to something
less delightful? This is, brace yourselves, everybody. It's time to talk about our main segment, which is how terrible Liberty University is.
Yep. I want to say this right now. There is no way to discuss this lawsuit without discussing sexual assault and rape on the Liberty University campus. If you're a show listener, you know how respectfully we try and approach those subjects for our listeners. We know we have listeners who are survivors of rape and sexual assault. We're going to have to talk about it. And if that's not something you're prepared or want to listen to right now, then you should skip this section. With that in mind, first, let me cut to the bottom line. This is a facially plausible, meritorious lawsuit against Liberty University. I'm going to walk you through, right, the OA method of reading a complaint backwards. The university has already said, we take this seriously, we're going to respond, we're going to look. They've already tried to do their, you know, some of these accusations are more than 20 years old, kind of backstep, but they have not mounted the kind of full court press that you would expect if they thought they could get away with that, right? They're like bringing in the Alliance Defending Freedom to say, you know, this is just secular society. It is. And again, it's a complaint. So, you know, we need to say that, but it's a complaint that is and should trouble Liberty and get them to take it seriously. Couple things from the press reporting that you need to know about. A lot of outlets are describing this as a class action. It is not a class action. It is a civil suit on behalf of 12 unnamed plaintiffs who are listed as Jane Doe's. It is about the Liberty Way, which is the honor code at Liberty University. And Liberty University, in classic fashion, has taken down the first link to its honor code on Google and put it behind a paywall. And I will actually include that link in the show notes that, you know, that their first step here was to make sure, you know, to try and make sure that snoops like me could not actually figure out what their honor code is, because, you know, that's more important.
That's a sign of a good honor code.
Right. Yeah, it's a secret. You have to have a student ID to log in and find it. But different components of it are still online. You can get it through the Wayback Machine, and it's attached as Exhibit A to the complaint. So, you know, nice try, Liberty, but it's not going to stop us from talking about it. By the way, since I think it's crucial to understanding the lawsuit, let me talk a little bit about the Liberty Way. This is like, I don't know if when you took your driver's exam, my son Alex is about to take his driver's test, so I guess this is on my mind. But if your state DMV had kind of the same system as mine, which was basically like, you got a number of points for stuff you did wrong on the course, and then a couple of infractions like jumping the curb or knocking over a cone, were in Maryland, those were 16-point infractions, and that got you an immediate fail, right? So otherwise, you could get up to 15 points taken off. So Liberty University's honor code is like that, okay? It has a bunch of things that it describes as infractions, and then you get a bunch of different points taken off you. And when you get to 30 points, you get suspended. And if you read, and I encourage you to do so, like I said, it's attached to the complaint. It will be linked in the show notes. If you read this honor code, some of it will strike you as, okay, you know, stuff a university might do, even a normal university, one that's not a cargo cult university, you know, masquerading as a school that is really just Christian indoctrination. So things like, oh, if you're late for well, I can't even give this one. It's not even late to class, right? If you're late to convocation or to curfew, nah. Again, real universities do not have curfews and convocations, but whatever, that's a one-point violation. If you fail to respond to a student affairs official call slip within 48 hours, that's a four-point violation, along with disturbances during convocation, violation of the school dress code. Again, pretty good sign you're not at a real university. But in any event, curfew violation, improper sign out, inappropriate personal contact, that is, you know, hugging somebody in public. So you get 4 points for that plus a $10 fine. You get 6 points. $10 fine. 6 points for use of e-cigarettes or vaping on campus, possession or use of tobacco, or any minor violation of the statement on personal and community respect, such as disrespect to faculty, staff, or fellow students, noise disturbance while on the hall, conduct that disrupts community or damages property, or minor use of profane language. 6 point violation.
Holy. So I can only say, gosh, you can't even say dang that. It like five times and then I'm expelled.
That is it. I will point out my freshman philosophy class, when it was covering a case called Cohen versus California, the professor, philosophy professor, would have violated this literally at our first class on this, because Cohen versus California was about a student who wore a jacket and on the back it said F the draft, right? Except it didn't say F, it said the word.
Frig.
Professor, yeah. And the professor said that word. And it's like, now imagine if instead of wearing a jacket that said F the draft, he had a little tape player and it walked around and it just played F the draft, F the draft, F the draft, F the draft. And so I'm just picturing, right, like this is like Demolition Man, right? You got five of these, that would be 30 points, and that professor would be kicked off of campus. Like you cannot teach a seminal case, Cohen versus California, without minor use of profane language.
What if you get a parrot to sit on your shoulder and say F the draft?
That would be amazing. Oh, so good. All right.
F the draft.
That's a really good impersonation of a parrot. Yeah. 12-point violation for deception, any minor violation on the statement of sexuality in relationships, such as visiting alone with the opposite sex at an off-campus residence, entering the residence hallway of an on-campus apartment of the opposite sex or allowing the same, visiting any dwelling or residence with a member of the opposite sex in, quote, inappropriate circumstances.
So, I would ask who the opposite sex is if you're non-binary, but I realize they probably just don't even let non-binary
people
exist.
Yeah, it's Liberty University. Yeah. Right, yeah. So that's a 12-point
binary
defense.
What would the opposite? I don't know. I'm
just right. 18-point violations. So this is more than halfway to suspension. Include the kinds of these are the kinds of things that a real university would take seriously.
Cheating.
Academic misconduct, including dishonesty, plagiarism, or falsification. Commission or conviction of a criminal misdemeanor. Falsification of information on an official document. Failure to properly identify oneself. That's a little Orwellian and weird, but intentional participation in a social gathering where alcohol is served, e.g. party, bar, or nightclub, or illegal drugs are used. Obscene, profane, or abusive language or behavior. And then violation of the entertainment guidelines. What are the entertainment guidelines? This used to be the straight line of you can't watch an R-rated movie. That is still the case. That is still the case. It is an 18-point violation to watch an R-rated movie.
Or imagine being at home or something, or you're visiting friends, or you're whatever, and you're 20, and then they're like, "Hey, let's watch Terminator 2." You're like, "I'm sorry, I'm going to have to leave. I can't."
You are required to self-report to the university, and it is an 18-point violation if you watch Terminator 2 with your friends at home on Christmas. I am not. I wish I were making this up. And can we please put to bed the idea?
Die Hard rated R? I can't remember.
Yes, the first Die Hard over Christmas at home with your
family. Die Hard over Christmas.
It has yippee-ki-yay, MF-er. Come on. You know, that's just explaining why you watched it would then get you another 12-point violation. So that would be, you'd be suspended right there.
So bad.
I've said R-rated movies, but remember, they've amended the code because now Hollywood is allowing some of that conduct in PG-13 movies. So Quote,
of course.
Liberty University maintains a conservative standard in its approach to the arts and entertainment, media and entertainment that is inconsistent with Liberty's standards and traditions, i.e. lewd lyrics, anti-Christian message, sexual content, nudity, pornography, etc., are not permitted on or off campus. So yes, if you watch a PG-13 movie in which, say, a comely young actor decides to go topless, that is an 18-point that is the equivalent of plagiarizing a paper at Liberty wow. University. So now we've had a good time laughing about this. I need to tell you, when you get to the 30-point, this is the automatic disciplinary suspension or possible administrative withdrawal.
So this is like if you watch Die Hard and Die Hard 2.
This is this is 30 points, right? 18 points is more than half the way there. 30 points are possession or consumption of alcoholic beverages, drugs, and commission of any felony. Unauthorized possession or use of weapons, okay. Stealing or possession of stolen property. Okay, I mean, the alcohol sure. seems a little crazy, but so be it. And also, procuring, financing, facilitating, or obtaining an abortion. That's a 30-point violation.
Just to make this perfectly clear, your doctor tells you you're going to die if you don't get an abortion. You're like, okay, well, it's either getting expelled or death, I guess, are my two options. Is that how it goes? Cool. Cool college, everybody.
And crucial to this lawsuit, violation of the statement on sexuality and relationship, including immorality or spending the night with a member of the opposite sex. In other words, a non-sexual spending the night with a member of the opposite sex is an automatic 30-point violation. You might ask yourself, where is sexual assault?
That must be in like the 900-point violations, I'm guessing. You know, we haven't gotten there yet.
Not specifically listed as an offense. Now, they would tell you, for example, they would say sexual misconduct and or any state of undress with member of the opposite sex. By the way, that's an 18-point violation, not a 30-point violation. They would say sexual assault would obviously come under the violation of the statement on sexuality and relationship, right? Any violation of the policy on sexual harassment, discrimination, and assault is punishable by up to 30 points. So as I read this, and again, I don't want to dwell too much. I will say, in light most favorable to Liberty University, the punishment for sexual assault is less than up to the same as the punishment for voluntary consensual sexual behavior, including voluntary consensual non-sexual behavior, that is, spending the night with a member of the opposite sex. And that, the reason I wasted all this time going through this nonsense, ridiculous, fake universities, fake codes, is the gravamen of this lawsuit. It is having an honor code like this that imposes up to, this is their words, it's in the complaint, turn to it, page 14 of Exhibit A. That is up to 30 points, implying it could be less than 30 points.
Yeah.
Violation of the statement on sexuality and relationship, that is the immorality, spending a night with a member of the opposite sex, is a hard 30 points. So under the view of this code that is most favorable to Liberty University, being a victim of sexual assault is equivalent to being the perpetrator of sexual assault.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's why I went through all of this, because the gravamen of this lawsuit is that the existence of this, the Liberty Way, the honor code policy, created and facilitated conditions on the Liberty University campus that made it more likely for people to be sexually assaulted.
Wow. Yeah, I think that's a pretty plausible claim, don't you?
I do too. I want to talk about some of the potential difficulties. And now I want to take a look at the lawsuit. So first thing you want to do is, as always, opening arguments, read the complaint backwards. So let's turn to the last page. Who's this complaint brought by? Who represents the 12 anonymous plaintiffs here? Jack Larkin of Gawthrop Greenwood, which is a law firm that is based in Eastern Pennsylvania and Delaware. That's a little bit of a weird choice. We're going to get to that in a second. But This guy has credentials, right? He's the head of their litigation department. He has previously sued a public university under Title IX, which is the basis for most of this lawsuit. He's not an Earth Court guy. He's a totally sane, sensible lawyer who litigates cases like this. So then you work backwards and ask, what are the counts that are being raised? There are seven of them. And to emphasize the skill of the attorney, these were things I had to look up for many of them. You know why? Because I'm not a Title IX litigator. So for example, counts one and two assert deliberate indifference, and they are divided into pre-assault and post-assault. And so the first thing I did was I looked up deliberate indifference. I'm like, is there a tort in Virginia of deliberate indifference? And I couldn't find one. Instead, I found that like when you are alleging a violation of your Eighth Amendment rights in prison, if the prison knows that you have a medical condition and then they deny you access to necessary medical care, the standard you need to show is deliberate indifference. And I'm like, okay, it seems kind of... And then I looked up I just did a search for cases with deliberate indifference Title IX. And as it happens, this is a specific cause of action that was recognized by the U.S. Supreme Court in a 1999 case called Davis versus Monroe County Board of Education, 526 U.S. 629. And it says that Title IX affords victims of student-on-student sexual harassment a private right of action for damages against schools that receive federal funding, like Liberty University. Under Davis, funding recipients, Liberty University, are properly held liable in damages when one student sexually harasses another, only where they were deliberately indifferent to sexual harassment, of which they have actual knowledge that is so severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive that it can be said to deprive the victims of access to the educational opportunities or benefits provided by the school.
Well, this sounds like, I don't know if you'd call it a law, but good law. I mean, this is like, you're federally funded. If we find out that you are indifferent, deliberately so, to sexual assault, then we're holding out that funding. Or it sounds like the funding is damages to the student. Is that what that sounded
like? Yeah, no, it's so the idea of a private right of action means that, yes, the student can directly sue the school for the damages that they suffered as a result of sexual harassment, because, right, suing another student is often, you know, not much relief in that way. So, you know, in particular, you talk about a 19-year-old, they're not going to have any assets, right? Mm-hmm. So being able to sue the school is the key towards those victims being able to be rendered whole for suffering extensive sexual harassment on campus. Look, that's a high bar, right? Like they have to be deliberately indifferent to this going on campus. You can understand. So on the one hand, you might argue that should be lowered some, right? Out of the idea that we want to make it easier for victims and survivors to bring these kinds of lawsuits. On the other hand, you know, you sort of have to balance that against the intervening cause argument, right? Like you would not want to make it such that a university is responsible for every act of private harassment by one student against another student. You got to draw the line somewhere, and the Supreme Court draws it in a way that is pretty favorable to the institution. This is a kind of super negligence, right? So you could fail to exercise ordinary care to prevent student-on-student sexual harassment and not wind up under the Davis cause of action for deliberate indifference. But if it is so extensive and so pervasive, and by the way, I'm not going into the specific facts alleged by the plaintiffs in this lawsuit. Again, they're allegations. This is why you have a lawsuit. And if they're not true, Liberty University will be able to mount a legal defense. These allegations would arise to that standard. Again, I'm going to talk about when we get to count seven, I have to give some more really disturbing details to understand what that counts about. But we don't have to do that here. We just have to know, right? So pre-assault, that is, the university knew its policy would facilitate sexual assault and rape on campus, which in fact happened, right? Can demonstrate that. And then the second count, which is Well, certainly after this happened again and again, you have to know that your policy that says sexual assault victims are equally culpable as rapists is facilitating that environment. And how is it facilitating that environment? We already have a culture of silence among survivors. And there are repeated allegations in this complaint that says, you know, university police in processing rape complaints would say things like, well, you know, you could go ahead and file this as an official complaint, but we're going to have to expel you if you do that because you would be admitting to a violation of the campus honor code. So that's the allegation. That's counts one and two. Count three is hostile environment. Now, we've talked about that before in the workplace, but it's also true under Title IX in the classroom. Hmm. And again, this can't be one incident. And I just want to make sure as we walk through this that you know, people understand I'm doing my best to steel bot the other side as much as possible. And so you might say, you know, we wouldn't want a law that says you can sue Microsoft because you show up and Gary from accounting says something stupid on day one.
And I don't think that's the other side. I mean, I think that's a reasonable way of handling these kinds of questions. I mean, the company itself should have at least an opportunity to say, whoa, 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 this guy's an a-hole, fire him, you know, and then not be like liable for whatever. And I mean, look, humans suck. I mean, that would be very unworkable if every single time an employee said something to another employee of any kind that was bad, the whole company is liable. It makes sense to at least give that entity a chance to deal with it in a reasonable fashion before they're liable, I would think, right?
And that layperson's explanation, expectations, is in fact exactly how Title IX implements hostile environment. Cannot be one incident. Must be pervasive. The university must have knowledge and then refuse to do anything to stop
right.
it. Really straightforward. Sexual harassment is unwelcome conduct of a sexual nature. It includes unwelcome sexual advances, requests for sexual favors, and other verbal, nonverbal, or physical conduct of a sexual nature. Title IX prohibits gender-based harassment, which is unwelcome conduct based on a student's sex, harassing conducts based on a student's failure to conform to sex stereotypes. Okay. Count four is retaliation. And again, if that word sounds familiar, we've talked about it in the employment context. Also true under Title IX, on a university that accepts federal funds, it protects any individual who reports sexual discrimination, sexual harassment, or sexual violence against retaliation in the workplace. That is, you know, being fired for telling on Greg from accounting or being passed over promotions or what have you. In the school environment, it is, you know, being disciplined, being kicked out of school for reporting sexual discrimination, harassment, or sexual violence. This seems to me to be, all of these arguments are very, very strong. This one seems virtually axiomatic at this point. Again, it's a complaint. We will look at, you know, the result. But yeah, it seems pretty clear Liberty University does that. Count five has kind of flown beneath the radar because it's less of sort of the truly icky quality. But this is one plaintiff, Jane Doe number five. This is a count for again, deliberate indifference. This is deliberate indifference and hostile environment for pregnant and parenting students.
Hmm.
And it's really interesting. It is that, you know, the policies are designed to treat Liberty University students like they're four-year-olds.
Yeah.
And so that creates a disparate environment when you have, you know, an actual adult who is either pregnant or parenting, particularly nursing, not hard to imagine that. So that's count five. Count six is negligence generally. And here, the weakness is going to be the intervening cause argument. And so count six is pled anticipating a comparative negligence defense. The university is going to say, yeah, well, it doesn't really matter if we were negligent because the person that committed the harm was the person who assaulted you. And so count six says, right, but you made it worse. And to the degree that you made it worse, that you emboldened that person, that you allowed that person to escape, that you're responsible for that. It's really, really interesting. I've never seen an argument like that, but there's nothing implausible about sort of affirmatively pleading a pro rata, you made it worse, you're responsible for the degree to which you made it worse. The court may say it's impossible to calculate that, but it may not. So I'm really interested in tracking that. Count seven is a specific civil remedy for personal injuries. It is 18 U.S.C. 2255. And here I would say go ahead and fast forward to T3BE if you don't want your heart broken. This is the story of Jane Doe number 12, who was on the Liberty University campus in the summer because she was a high school debater. As you might imagine, this hits me pretty personally. So she was there attending Liberty University's debate camp as a teenager, as possibly a rising sophomore, right? 15 years old. She alleges that she was assaulted by a Liberty University football player named Jesse Matthew Jr. in 2000. Jesse Matthew Jr. is currently serving four consecutive life sentences after having pled guilty to the murders of UVA wow. student Hannah Graham and Virginia Tech student Morgan Harrington in 2009 and 2014. Assaulted, attempted to rape and killed, pled guilty to their murders. And she details being assaulted by this football player and then went to report the assault. And it claims, again, there are allegations, that the Liberty University Police Department told her that she could be, quote, expelled from the debate camp because she was wearing pants in an academic building, which was at the time a violation of the Liberty Way, a violation of the dress code, and that she would be criminally charged with filing a false police report if she refused to withdraw her sexual assault report against Jesse Matthew Jr. It includes allegations that while at the police station, one of the officers high-fived Matthew and said, "Hey, man, I want to get your autograph. It's going to be famous someday." Then it says the police began an investigation into her claim, which seemed to consist of a demand that she strip and submit to being photographed by the chief of police.
Wow.
She refused and said, "I would like to have a doctor or nurse examine me for injuries," and that that person could then take a sample of DNA from under her nails from her fighting back. The police refused to transport Doe 12 to the hospital and instead insisted until she agreed to allow herself to be photographed by the female debate coach. Claim says that her mother was never contacted regarding the photographs, that she never consented to the photographs, and that after learning that Jerry Falwell Jr. was trafficking in photographs of women taken at Liberty University,
wow.
is concerned that these photographs, which are described from the complaint described as not plausibly related to a medical investigation. I'm just going to say it like that.
So it's unsure whether or not this is in that asshole's like personal
correct
collection. Okay.
Correct. And then it says before allowing her to leave, the complaint states that the police required her to wash her hands.
Wow.
Which would destroy any DNA evidence, and then to present her nails for inspection. And when asked about the nails, they said, "Well, yeah, but you know, of course, right? You would have his DNA under your nails because you know the sex was consensual."
I have a question.
Yeah,
this is from 2000 something, right? This is very old.
Yeah,
what's going to be the statute of limitations on these kinds of complaints? Because this isn't against the actual rapist. This is against the school for how they're handling it. What would the kind of the statute of limitations be on that kind of claim?
It's a really, really good, it is the best question you can ask here. And let me tell you, the answer is that I don't know. I will tell you this case was filed in New York. And the reason that it was filed in New York, not that, again, remember, New York court will have to apply its own conflicts of laws, right? This was a T3BE question, is that the complaint is up front about trying to figure out what counts for purposes of a statute of limitations here. So number one, the statute of limitations runs from discovery. So allegations about the university where you are not aware of, for example, the photographs being potentially distributed, right? You might have a plausible argument that says, I didn't become aware of that complaint until I realized Jerry Falwell Jr., you know, had. So there may be some discovery rule arguments here, but there was also a section, labeled statute of limitations. And again, this is really good lawyering. This is page 3 of the complaint that says Title IX has no explicit statute of limitations. And as a result, federal courts apply the most appropriate or analogous statute of limitations. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit has determined that Title IX actions are most analogous to personal injury actions. While this generally yields a 3-year statute of limitations, the most analogous statute of limitations here is New York City Public Law 213-C, which provides a 20-year statute of limitations for the adult victims of sexual offenses, and Section 208 for the minor victim of sexual offenses. So that's the argument they are frontlining in their brief. You are 100% correct. That will be the argument. And against that argument are nobody is within 3 years of the commission of these offenses. But there will be 3 lines of argumentation that are presented. Number one is that the analogous statutes of limitation are longer than 3 years, right? That's what I just read. Mm-hmm. Number two is that the causes of action were not discovered until recently. And number three is a doctrine called equitable tolling. And equitable tolling is whenever you see something preceded by equitable in a legal context, it means, yeah, the law doesn't say this, but we need to do this in order to be fair. And so you can a court can decide to equitably toll a statute of limitations in certain circumstances where it would seem to be grossly unfair to apply that statute of limitations. So I don't know how that's going to come out, but that's how the argument is going to be framed. And that's where the battle over this lawsuit will take place.
Yeah, yeah. You said there are 12 Jane Does, I suppose?
Correct.
How many were this same guy? Do we know that?
That particular, the football player is only, as far as we can tell, is only Jane Doe number 12.
Okay.
So he is named, this is paragraph 233 of the complaint that says, paragraph 232, shortly before a scheduled debate practice round, Doe 12 realized that she had forgotten her notes in the dorm, returned to her room. While in the hall, Doe 12 met with a soft-spoken man who identified himself as either LJ, RJ, or RC. She was uncertain at the time. She later became aware that this man was Jesse Matthew. This is the only reference in this section to Jesse Matthew. So, yeah.
And then, so are the 12 or the 11 others, it's just all different allegations that were covered up by different dudes? Or I was just wondering if there's any like repeat problem that they kept protecting.
It is possible that there are some repeats, but it is so.
Not that it matters. I'm just trying to get a
picture. No. That's right. So for example, right, Doe 6 was dating a graduate of the school. Right. This is begins at paragraph 158, and it says that in December of 2013, Doe 6's boyfriend invited her to his house where he served her 2 glasses of wine. After immediately drinking the second glass of wine, Doe 6 became substantially immobile from what was apparently a date rape drug. Doe 6's male partner then climbed on top of her. I'm not going to read the rest of it. After she was released from the hospital, Liberty University advised Doe 6 that she would be offered counseling from the university and scheduled an appointment for her. Doe 6 understood that the counseling was intended to be an opportunity for her to discuss her rape. Instead, she was confronted by Liberty for drinking and fined $500. She was told her transcript would not be released unless and until she paid the $500.
Oh my God.
Doe completed the quarter and then transferred to a different school. Thank God she got out of that.
Imagine how many victims there are that didn't speak up or didn't join this lawsuit. I mean, there's got to be tons.
Yeah. Again, remember, we read from the current as attached to this complaint, possession or consumption of alcoholic beverages is a 30-point offense, right? Has a $500 fine. That's why that's the importance of that. And is mandatory suspension from the school, right? So again, voluntary sex, voluntary alcohol is the same level of offense at Liberty University as sexual assault and drugging and raping someone.
This is a big deal, you know, because this kind of policy, maybe in this day and age, I don't know what'll happen with this case. I'm going to ask you what you think in a minute, obviously, but like maybe going forward, these kinds of policies, which are so terrible, I don't even know what the right word is. I mean, it's rape culture. I mean, the idea that like these other things are as bad, these other consensual activities that adults every day take part in are as bad as sexual assault. hopefully we can get to the point where that's ugly enough, that's bad enough, that's detrimental enough to the students that you would have at your university that you just can't do that anymore. I mean, I guess we have to say if you're going to receive federal funds, I suppose that's as far as we're allowed to go. Yeah, it seems like, yeah, if you don't receive federal funds, you can do whatever the hell you want or something. But I hope we get to a point where it's not like, oh, well, see, this is the religious university and they get to be puritanical bullshit people. You know, it's like, no, maybe this is so detrimental and so backwards that it creates an environment that is unacceptable for students, and we should not allow policies like that to be in anything that is federally funded.
Yeah, but instead what we have are 30 states rushing to introduce bills to prevent universities from teaching critical race theory.
Ah, yes, so, yes. Yeah. This is often brought up during the campus craziness stuff, you know, where it's like, oh, the kids, they're yelling at a teacher who used racial slurs, and like, so therefore they're out of control in the crazy campus craziness. And it's like, okay, but look at this university. You know, there's not a lot of attention. You used to say this all the time, didn't you, Andrew? Like during these campus craziness debates, no attention put on Liberty University and the absolute bullshit they're doing. That's somehow not the sky falling. That's somehow not, you know, kids need to be exposed to dangerous ideas like Die Hard 1. You know, like college is the place. There's none of that talk when it comes to Liberty University. They can't even watch rated R movies. Are you kidding me? Anyway, sorry, this whole thing. Nope. I mean, that's not the most, don't get me wrong, this is not the most frustrating part of this thing. It's just another thing about it that's frustrating. The most frustrating part of this thing and the most sickening part of this thing is the obvious amounts of sexual assault that were actively covered up by a university. And it's sickening. And by the way, somebody who went on to murder two women is one of the alleged people that the university covered up for. So that's the kind of thing that this behavior leads to.
Yeah.
So anyway, this freaking sucks, Andrew.
I know.
But we had to cover it.
It's newsworthy. I want people to understand. I want people to understand, you know, that this is a facially plausible, well thought out, well argued lawsuit. Because, you know, that's part of why people turn to our show.
Yeah. Do you think the first battle is going to be the statute of limitations?
Absolutely. Okay. What you are going to see is a motion to dismiss from Liberty University on statute of limitations grounds. They will be assiduously doing their best to settle this lawsuit while that motion is pending. Because if this goes to discovery, this will be disastrous for Liberty University. There is not a chance that they're going to want that to happen.
Oh, boy. Well, shut this stupid school down. Burn it to the ground. Sorry, no, I guess I shouldn't go that far, but that's what I'm thinking. This should not exist. Screw this. This is awful rape culture garbage that no one should be exposing their college-age kids to.
I don't think we have a lot of listeners who are likely to attend or send their kids to attend Liberty University.
If we do, please don't.
Yeah. I mean, this is in Doe number 12's response. And again, right, I mean, the debate coach stuff hits me really hard. Let me say it this way, okay? Because this is where it's contained. It says, you know, my parents were concerned about me as a young teenager going off for a couple of weeks to a debate camp, right, and staying overnight at a university. And they thought that a Christian university would make that more likely that I would be safe rather than less. And my son's doing debate camp virtually this year. But 2 years ago, right, I sent him off to University of Pennsylvania when he was, you know, that age. He was 15. And I love that. And he loved it. And, you know, that is such an important part of growing up. And I know we have parents that want what's best for their kids. And that background assumption, even among our liberal, largely secular audience, right? We have a lot of people who aren't religious. That background thought of like, oh, well, the more conservative an environment is religiously and culturally, the better the place that will be for my child.
Yeah, like that's correlated with safety in some way.
You would think. And I totally, and that's what I'm just, when I read this, I mean, we all know Liberty University's garbage, but I could totally understand a parent going like, yeah, I would never send my kid to Liberty University. Would I let him go to the Liberty University debate camp? You bet. And of course, you might think that. So I want to wrap the segment up. And obviously it's been hard for both of us, and probably hard on a lot of our listeners. One of the repeated questions that we get, you know, and sometimes when the news is at its worst, we would get the questions of like, I don't know why you do the show. Like, the law's all made up and nothing matters. And, you know, Trump isn't going to jail and there are no consequences for anybody for doing anything. Is to illustrate, I mean, this is part of what I do love about my profession, and that, you know, not everything is broken, and sometimes there are consequences, and, you know, noting the ways in which different aspects can kind of come together and provide for an opportunity for people who were victimized by a school's policy to be able to come together and get some kind of measure of justice, right? Like, that is, I know it's been a hard segment, but to me, that's one of the best aspects of the law. And so I really do want to end with that kind of, these cases are bad, but that's why this complaint exists.
That's why, what hopefully the law is there to do is, hopefully, we'll see, but yeah, hopefully it will provide some amount of relief to victims in this way. Yep. And create change,
yeah,
you know, take away exactly the money that is funding this bullshit, and maybe it'll incentivize that change. But
absolutely.
Well, that's a tough one, Andrew. But I'm really glad we covered it, because it's awful and people need to know about it. You know, we can't, the more we sweep these things under the rug, the less there's any chance of things happening about it. And that's why I'm glad we covered it. Glad to hear that, in your opinion, this is a meritorious lawsuit. Hopefully something happens as a result of this.
Absolutely.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
Andrew, I'm going to let you cheer yourself up. You know what? Ask me a real property question. Just do your worst. Just whatever.
I have something even worse than real property. No. I'm serious. Wait. Get a gander. You're on a 5-question winning streak, Thomas. And
it might be 4, but yeah,
and
sure.
It's time to bring you down a peg. So that's,
you know what? It's fine. I'm going to allow it. It's right. It'll help everybody feel better.
So, Thomas, a patent holder brought a patent infringement action in federal court against a licensee of the patent. The patent holder believed that a jury would be more sympathetic to his claims than a judge, and asked his lawyer to obtain a jury trial.
Oh, shoot.
What should the lawyer do to secure the patent holder's right to a jury trial? A, file and serve a complaint that includes a jury trial and demand. B, file and serve a jury trial demand at the close of discovery. C, file and serve a jury trial demand within 30 days after the close of the pleadings. Or D, make a jury trial demand at the initial pretrial conference.
Yeah, okay. No, I see what you're saying. This is one that's like, you got to be a lawyer and know the rules. Otherwise, it's going to be very hard to just intuit what you should do. Patent holder brought a patent infringement action in federal court. Federal court against licensee of the patent holder. I guess it would have to be because it's patent. Yeah, okay. Believe the jury would be more sympathetic than a judge. Ask the lawyer to obtain a jury trial. What should the lawyer do to secure the patent holder's right to a jury trial? Okay, so I guess the question seems to be, it's one that I'm not going to be able to get, but it's like, do you have to do that right away? So I feel like this probably, the answer is probably going time order, it seems like. Let's see, file and serve a complaint. The complaint that includes a jury trial demand. Now, let me think. Do, in the past of the show, when we read complaints, do they include like a jury trial demand? Part of me thinks they do. I mean, I don't think we cover it much because it doesn't, it's usually not something we analyze, you know, but I, for whatever reason, I feel like you do put that in the complaint, but I'm not sure. Okay. File and serve a jury trial demand. File and serve a jury trial demand at the close of discovery. Close of discovery. Close of discovery. That also makes sense, you know? I think it's like, you're not doing discovery in front of a jury. So it kind of makes sense to be like, wait, you know, like, let's evaluate certain things about the complaint first that might, you know, dismiss it out of hand or just whatever, or whatever it might be. Do that first. And then after we're done with discovery, then we talk about what kind of trial you might want. B seems pretty plausible to me. Unfortunately, they're all going to seem plausible. C, file and serve a jury trial demand within 30 days after the close of pleadings. I don't know. That seems weird. I don't really understand pleadings. So that's like you've already done everything. I don't know. I guess this sucks. Yeah, I got to be a lawyer. D, make a jury trial demand at the initial pretrial conference. Okay, what should the lawyer do? What's interesting is it feels like all of these should probably be fine, but apparently not. Based on the logic of the question, there's only one of these that will secure the patent holder's right to a jury trial. This is real tough. I think they're all plausible. C is the weirdest to me, but again, it could still totally be plausible. Initial pretrial conference. That feels a little late. D feels late. You're at a pretrial conference and you're like, I want a jury. And then you got to do voir dire. I don't know. I feel like that's late. I could be wrong, but let's eliminate D. Again, there's no freaking way I'm getting this. So let's eliminate D. And let's eliminate, you know, C just seems so weird to me. I don't know that maybe that's right, but if just something about it seems wrong. I'm going to eliminate C and D. I think I'm between A and B. And I think that the close of discovery, something's leaping out to me about B. I feel like it's like the natural time you would do it. You know, I don't know why. I have no confidence in this. I'm going to go between A and B, and I'm going to say it's B, and let's see if the coin's probably going to finally get me on one. We'll see. Does the coin agree? The coin disagrees. Wow, there's been a lot of tails lately on these coins. So the coin is going with A, and I'm going with B. Final answer.
All right, and if you want to play along with Thomas and the coin, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media. Include the hashtag T3BE. Include your guess and your reasons therefore. And we will pick a winner and shower that winner with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
Andrew, I hope you and all the listeners feel better. You've embarrassed me, but I feel like you earned it after that segment, so...
Well, time will tell as to whether I have embarrassed you or not.
And thank you.
And now it's time to thank our new patrons at patreon.com/law, who, by the way, are enjoying that lot amazing sanctions. Seriously, you got to check it out. It's so much fun. It's 2 hours. We play highlights from the sanctions of the Kraken lawyers. We make jokes. Andrew makes brilliant legal points. It's fantastic. Go check it out. Here are some people who may be checking it out if they pledged at the $2 level. And Andrew, start us off.
Thank you, too. Has you or a loved one been hurt by shady seafood? Call the law offices of Habeas Porpoise today. To John Felchek, to read the Powell memo, listen to Senator Whitehouse on the scheme, U.S. authority cap, government takeover origin story in real life. To Robert Zellers, to Kite Ellipsis, and to Jewish Monk. And I also want to give a separate shout out to Freethinker215, who PayPal'd us a very nice donation and sent us a lovely message. So thanks. Thanks also to Freethinker215.
And I will say, I know a Robert Zellers. I have no idea if it's the same one, but if that's you, hey, how's it going? Thanks for pledging. Yeah. Either way. And thank you to Colin Maycock. I don't know if that's a prank one. It's great when you have a name that's close enough to a prank one that, you know, like Oliver Hiscock or something, you know, like Colin Maycock, 124mm10, okay, a 37-year-old Canadian construction worker who was inspired by OA to get his undergraduate and hopefully his JD. Oh, awesome.
Woo.
Super cool. How does Andrew feel about Paul F. Tompkins stealing his voice? Really? I like Paul F. Tompkins. I've never... Yeah. Notice that comparison.
I wouldn't have thought so, but I'll have to give him an extra listen now.
Maybe we can get him to guest and pretend to be you. That'd be awesome. Congrats, Jens and Naomi, two great doctors stamping out COVID in Florida and expecting a baby this year. That's awesome. Congrats. Ooh. That's super cool. Every part of that.
Yes.
Except the Florida
part. And
that
person also messaged us, so thank you. Yeah.
Brad Lawrence and Singing in the Raining Indictments. All right. Thank you so much. Hope you enjoy the content. And that's our show, a rough one, but a necessary one. Thank you, Andrew. I know that was tough to have to delve into all those details. So thanks for doing that. For those of us like me who maybe couldn't have gone through all that, we really appreciate you. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. And next Tuesday is going to be another hopefully Uncle Frank worthy version of the show. So we're going to CRT Critical Race Theory Part 3.
All right. Excited for that. We'll see you all then.
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah. That's why you're the judge and I'm the law talking guy.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it will be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.